It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Burlingame, California. Sean Stannard Stockton is the President and Chief Investment Officer of Ensemble Capital Management and Portfolio Manager of the Ensemble Fund. In addition to advising the fund, Ensemble Capital manages nearly $700 million in separate accounts on behalf of families and charitable institutions. Prior to Ensemble, Sean worked at Scudder Investments. He holds a BA in economics from the University of California at Davis. Sean has shared his wisdom and insights with our members in the past, and we are very grateful he has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So, on behalf of the MOI Global Membership Community, a very warm welcome to you, Sean. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Thanks so much, John. Really a pleasure to be here as well. I've gotten a lot of value out of the Manual Ideas Network, and it's really a pleasure to be here. So John gave a brief introduction of Ensemble and just a little bit more in depth. As he mentioned, we're a wealth management firm providing separate account management as well as managing a core equity mutual fund. And really from an investment philosophy standpoint, our focus is on finding competitively advantaged or moaty businesses rather than thinking of ourselves as growth or value investors. Our valuation process is entirely intrinsic value based, meaning that it's not based on what we think other investors will pay us for a security at some point in the future, but rather what we expect to earn from the distributable cash flow streams of the business over the kind of the very long term if we were to hold the business forever. The equity strategy holds between 15 and 30 positions with weights ranging from 1 to 9%. And historically, we've had an active share that runs around 90% or so. So if you want to learn more about the investment philosophy overall, we regularly write the Intrinsic Investing blog and maintain a presence on Twitter. And we believe, and it's kind of part of why we're part of the MOI Global Network, is that the way in which the investment community kind of shares ideas is rather remarkable. Most other competitive businesses don't do that. But it's really one of the primary ways in which we get new ideas to look at and to do our own work on. And so it's a pleasure for us to get to share one of our ideas. We found this idea, First Republic, back in 2012 from another smart investor who was sharing his ideas. We don't use screens when looking for new ideas. Every occasionally, if nothing to look at, we might run a screen or two. But really, new ideas come from coming across small but important insights into why a company may have built a strong set of competitive advantages. So we read Manual Ideas religiously and we engage with the broader network because frequently it exposes us to kind of small but important insights that help us, you know, direct our energy for research. So this quote from Sean Kravitz of Esplanade Capital is a great example. He says, "We consider First Republic a retail business with a superior franchise. We don't typically find the banking industry to be an attractive place to look for opportunities. We know a lot of value investors do, but for us, we don't. It's not much interest, and I'll show a chart in a moment that shows why First Republic's different. But this quote by Sean was, you know, certainly not a reason just to buy a stock outright, but it was this to say, wait, a retail business with a superior franchise, I thought First Republic was a bank. And you know, he elaborated more, and those thoughts were compelling, and so that led us back in 2012 to research the company, and we liked what we found. And so what we found was that while the company generates its earnings through taking in customer deposits and lending them back out like any bank, they compete on an entirely different set of axes than a traditional bank. And as Sean says, and I'll explain, for investors, First Republic is best understood as a retail business rather than as a bank. So this is, you know, breaking down Michael Porter's different competitive advantages. Along the top, you have kind of either cost leadership or differentiation on a broad basis. Along the bottom, the same competitive advantages, but in a focused niche area. And so for most of the big banks, what Kravitz calls the big dumb banks across the street, First Republic is not just buying and selling money as in kind of the ultimate commodity business model. Instead, they're selling kind of peace of mind and the time savings that comes from having a customer service focused organization taking care of their high net worth clients' business or banking needs. So as I mentioned earlier, we always put competitive moats at the center of our analysis. And we believe that with First Republic, they're engaged in this totally different set of competitive aspects that are built around having a culture, an internal culture of customer service that's far more often found in high-end consumer brand companies rather than in banks. In theory, their moat could be penetrated by almost any other bank that has decided and made the choice to adopt the model. And there's nothing about saying you offer high-end customer service that nobody else can do in theory, but just like investing, where a lot of the things that we all do in this community are simple, they're hard to actually execute on. And we think there's a kind of a deep set cultural norms in the banking industry that prevents competitors from replicating what First Republic's doing. And if somebody were to do that, maybe a new entrant, it would really take a decade or more for a similar competitor to kind of build out a model of any sort of similar scale. First Republic's been at work on this for the last 30 years, and we think it's a slow process to build both the internal culture and the external brand awareness. So we think about the bank industry, and we think about Porter's quadrant chart here. Most big banks are in the upper left kind of cost leadership quadrant, right? It's a commodity business. They're competing on price. Big banks with low cost of funds can offer, you know, lower cost loans and obtain customers, and they can earn a spread for that, and that's great. But they, you know, it's not a moat business. And you can tell this is the case because advertisements from most banks to the customers emphasize either high rates on deposits they're paying or low rates on borrowing, and both of those are elements of using price to compete. Some of the big global banks would be more often thought of as in the upper right, kind of broad differentiation bucket. They can offer things like global currency management or risk hedging or things that smaller banks generally can't. And so they can differentiate themselves based on scale and expertise in very complex financial matters. Your kind of small local banks and credit unions would be in the lower left. You know, that they're you know, credit unions might offer high rates on savings accounts or high rates on the CDs or, you know, or free ATM withdrawals, but it's all cost-based again, and they'll have some local focus that they'll compete in. But First Republic is the rare bank that competes in the lower right differentiation focused quadrant. So they don't compete by offering the cheapest prices or, importantly, by loosening their lending standards. It's just not what they do. They compete by offering best-in-class customer service within an industry that is often despised by its own customer base. And so, you know, First Republic says this is what they do. You can look at their advertisements, selling it, but the proof's in how their customers actually perceive them. So this chart shows net promoter score ranking for First Republic, along with other kind of quote-unquote peers. Their closest peers, when thinking about net promoter scores, which we think is one of the best ways to think about customer satisfaction, some of their closest peers are Nordstrom's and Ritz-Carlton, two retail businesses that have differentiated themselves through customer service. And so this is the way to think about who their competition is. Of course, they don't compete with Ritz-Carlton and Nordstrom's in the sense that they sell an entirely different product. But in terms of what their business model, what they're really actually all about, it's actually closer to this than kind of your traditional commodity-based bank. Note that they rank higher than both Amazon and Apple. And it isn't just that they rank high, but that they rank high while operating within an industry that offers extremely low customer satisfaction ratings. I mean, a 34% net promoter score means that your customers really don't think anybody else should do business with you. And that's where the banking industry operates. It's not just net promoter scores. This is Gallup polls. And so according to Gallup, Americans hold the banking industry in really low regard relative to other industries. And it's why First Republic's customer satisfaction scores are so notable. And it's not just the customers, actually. According to another Gallup poll, only 34% of bank employees say that their company delivers on their brand promise. So the industry in which First Republic is operating is one in which the competitors have customers who don't particularly like them and have employees who don't particularly think they're doing a great job. And it is within that industry that the bank has differentiated themselves by creating a customer service model that puts them on par with some of the best in class customer service organizations in the world. On the employee aspect, I would note that First Republic has such strong employee engagement and kind of employee satisfaction that 90% of all of the loans that they've originated since their founding 30 years ago were written by a banker who is still an employee of the company. So, you know, users are not seeing rapid turnover here. Go to the average bank, that's just not the case. And it is part of the internal culture that's so hard to replicate, to have a bank in which you had a multi-decade long history of loans being written by people who are still there, still working with the customers who they wrote the loan to, is not something that you can create overnight. Those scores are kind of quantitative, but you know, I put these photos up to show what they actually mean. So, you know, the scores don't capture the full issue. And these are photos of employees and customers of many of the big banks. They're not happy, right? And this is the industry in which First Republic competes. And you know, this isn't like a liberal thing. A lot of the protesters here may have liberal-leaning political views. But according to Gallup, again, only 36% of Republicans said they have a, quote, great deal of confidence in banks, which is only a little bit higher than the 30% of Democrats that say the same thing. So this is kind of a really widespread issue that the big banks face and which First Republic is taking advantage of. So, you know, it's nice to say we have high customer service, but what really matters is what does it do for shareholders? And over the past 30 years, it's reaped enormous rewards for shareholders. Over the last 30 years, it generated 24% annual growth in enterprise value. And what's even more remarkable, I hope you can see this on the screen here, I'll circle it right here, you'll notice the flat lines. This is a management team that built an enormous amount of value in the bank through 2007 and then sold the bank just a year or so before the financial crisis, and then bought it back in 2010. So this is exactly the sort of management team that you want to see managing your money, creating enormous value through kind of organic business execution, and then recognizing when it's time to sell and when it's time to buy. The geographic mix of this business is kind of one of the most important things that sets them apart. They are extremely focused in their end market strategy. So you can see that going back 15 years ago, about 80% of all of the bank's customers were in San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles. Today, the New York market has grown really significantly. We're in kind of taking share from San Francisco, only in terms of the mix of First Republic's business has grown faster than San Francisco. But all three markets are growing rapidly as well. And so, you have just those three markets making up 80% of this bank. The chart shows that 90% of all the real estate loans are located within 20 miles of a First Republic office. So this is not certainly not a global bank, and it's barely even a national bank, although it is a over $50 billion asset bank, and it's, you know, one of the big players. But these markets are unique in that they grow quickly and they're full of kind of very wealthy people. So they only have about 4% market share in their markets of high net worth households. But those markets, while they only have 20% of the population in the United States live in these markets, about 60% of all of the high net worth households live there. So despite only having kind of significant presence in these limited markets, they already have access to 60% of their total addressable market, right? They're not looking to serve non-high net worth individuals. And so in terms of where their actual clients are, they're already there. And yet their market share is just about 4%. So they have enormous room to continue to grow. So, you know, we're talking about how they compete on a different set of metrics. Part of that is customer service and just a good old fashioned being nice people and honest people and yet selling many of the same kind of products that banks sell. But it's important to think about what does First Republic not do when you think about what it is that they do. So there's no proprietary trading. There's no credit derivatives. They don't have any credit cards or auto loans. In fact, what they don't do is pretty much the whole list of activities that make big banks hard for us at Ensemble as generalists to analyze. So one of the problems that we have with looking at big banks, even if we found their business model attractive, is that their balance sheets are complicated, honestly, and we're not bank accountants. And we look at some events over the last 10 years and wonder whether the banks themselves have a full understanding of their own balance sheets. And so with First Republic, they just don't do most of the activities that make banks difficult to understand or difficult to analyze businesses. Another thing they don't do is they don't sell the servicing on the loans that they originate. So while they do sell some loans to maintain a loan book that's not overly exposed to interest rate changes, which we'll talk about a little bit here, they always maintain the servicing of the loan so they can provide top-notch customer service. So that's unusual. For most of you who bought a house, you get a loan and it's sold like 3 days later, right? And maybe it's sold a couple different times and you have to reset up, you know, auto pay and all those sorts of things. First of all, it just doesn't do that. So if you get a loan from First Republic, your banker will be the person you call. And that doesn't just mean you get an 800 number to call. It's that, you know, like Rachel at First Republic is my main private banker. And if I had a loan through First Republic, I'd call Rachel. And 5 years later, it would be Rachel. That's how it works at First Republic. Remember, 90% of loans are originally available at bankers that are still there. And so, you know, when you work with First Republic, you have a real person that you're working with over the very long term. So what those are things they don't do. So what do they do? It's amusing, but this slide probably captures what they do according to social media and Yelp. So if you read reviews of First Republic on Yelp or you search social media for comments about them, you'll find an enormous number of photos of cookies. And you might even think that this must be like a cookie company, right? Every branch office at First Republic fresh bakes cookies every day for their customers. And it's something that their customers mention regularly when talking about the bank. So think about, you know, why is a customer of one of the big banks, what do they like? Well, my rate's low, or they get me a good, you know, yield on my savings. And for First Republic, they're saying, they brought me really nice cookies. They're really nice people. When I opened my personal accounts at First Republic back in 2012, they sent a banker, this Rachel who I mentioned, to my office to sign all the paperwork, and she brought with her fresh baked cookies. So, you know, this is, you know, kind of an amusing thing, and yet it speaks to what the bank thinks is important and what people think is important, what their customers think. Now, obviously, their customers don't really care about free cookies as your high net worth families who are banking with them. But it speaks to in a totally different way of interacting with a bank than most people are used to. So what do they really do? Of course, what they're doing is they're taking in deposits and they're lending them out. And the first thing is to bring in those deposits, and their customer service and their client retention and the referrals they get from their customers has caused money to simply pour into the bank, growing deposits at a 20% rate for the last decade. And these deposits make up 85% of the bank's liabilities. So they're the raw material that allow the bank to grow without a lot of external funding, external borrowing. Attracting and retaining these low-cost funds is a key part of the payoff that the company gets from serving customers so well. So 60% of these deposits are checking accounts, and the rate on these funds is really low. And note that these are organically grown deposits. So while they have a wealth management arm that acquires advisors from other wealth managers from time to time, and certain deposits can kind of flow through those acquisitions, they don't buy other banks. And so this is really an organic growth story. Those deposits, of course, turn into loans, which have grown at that same 20% rate over that time period. And so it's this fuel, it's this way in which the customers are happy and decide to consolidate all of their cash holdings at First Republic, which earns quite a low rate of yield, which allows the bank to lend money back out at reasonable rates, although they don't compete very heavily. It's not the cheapest place in the world to borrow money, but for a high net worth individual looking to take a loan out to buy a new home, sure, they want a competitive rate, but they're not looking to knock 10 basis points off their loan as much as they are to get the loan open in a smooth way. And anyone who's ever refinanced their house or applied for a loan knows that it's an extremely expensive process in terms of your own time and brain damage to go through. And so working with an organization that makes that easy and pleasant, or as pleasant as possible, is a huge benefit to somebody who has the money to pay for those sorts of those conveniences. Notably, we think they can keep growing like this for some time. We wouldn't expect that it would stay at a 20% rate. But remember, they only have about 4% market share of their own addressable market in terms of high net worth individuals in the geographic areas in which they are already operating. So when you see a bank growing loans very quickly, one thing that should come to mind is gosh, maybe they are loosening their lending standards. Maybe they're making bad loans, and maybe this all looks great now, but over time it's going to blow up on them. That's not been the situation at First Republic. So their credit quality is outstanding. You have an average residential mortgage loan to value is just 60% with a FICO score of 774. And note that the average borrower has deposits at First Republic in their checking and savings accounts equal to about 80% of their loan value. So not only is it secured by the house at a 60% loan to value, but they have enormous cash reserves on hand. And so the high net worth individuals who bank with them tend to carry a lot of cash. And that was reflected on First Republic's balance sheet. In terms of actual loss experiences, this shows the losses not only on their single family home loans, which is kind of their primary offering to their high net worth clients, but on their entire loan book going back to 2002. You can see it's been very low, much lower than their competitors. They've charged, well, the top 50 banks on average have charged off about 45 basis points of their loan book per year. First Republic has averaged less than a fifth of that, or just 8 basis points. So this chart's gone back to 2002. If you go back to their inception in 1985, you'll see that they've only written down about 7 basis points on single family homes and 17 basis points across all of their loans. So this is a bank that makes loans to people who are able to pay the money back, right? And at the end of the day, if you think about the housing crisis, what it came down to was people lending money to customers who could not pay the money back. And in many cases, kind of came to light that the lenders didn't expect that they would be able to pay it back, but they didn't really care because they were going to sell the loan, right? In this case, First Republic is making loans to people and underwriting loans in such a way that they get paid back, and they are not using loosening lending standards as a way to grow. So, you know, if you saw your kind of average regional bank growing super fast and they had kind of an average credit quality loan book, we at Ensemble would just pass and say, you know, who knows, maybe their loan book's great, maybe credit quality is fine, but we're not bank industry experts, and something could blow up here on us. But at First Republic, we have a very high degree of confidence that the bank is making the right decisions when it comes to lending standards. It's interesting to note that in 2009, their own losses only got as high as their peers' average annual losses. So the losses that they experienced at the crux of the financial crisis is what the average large bank deals with every single year. You know, I don't highlight all this to say that First Republic is somehow more brilliant underwriters or better at credit scoring. It's that they're not competing in the commodity market of lending money, right? And so this speaks to the fact that they're operating along a different set of competitive principles. And in order to lend with such high standards, you must be offering customers something else besides cheap prices or loose lending standards. And so for them, it's the customer service. And so when we look at this chart, it's easy to say, well, they just must be really prudent underwriters. But what they're really doing is they are selling customer service. And in response to that, they're able to say no to people who aren't very high credit quality. And for people who are, they're willing to say yes to First Republic because they like the customer service. This chart shows their net interest margin. And I mentioned, you know, numerous times now, we're generalist investors. First Republic's the only bank in our portfolio. And so, you know, high loan quality is really important, but so is an ability to manage your net interest margin in a way that doesn't require us to be assessing the yield curve regularly over time. And of course, we have a view on that, but we want to make an investment in an entity that is not overly correlated with assumptions about the yield curve way off in the future. So despite the wide range in Fed funds over the last 15 years, their net interest margin has run in a really narrow range. And this is because they sell off their long-term fixed rate loans. And they have what you might think of as pricing power in terms of their ability to not pay high interest rates on their deposits, right? So as interest rates go up, people worry, you know, well, you know, people are going to move their cash to other banks that offer higher yields. There's some of that, of course, but First Republic has been doing this for a long time. And despite not offering the highest yield on checking and savings, they have rapidly grown their assets, they're using their deposits, because their clients are not seeking an extra 10, 15, 20 basis points on a savings account. They're seeking customer service. And this is the difference between operating in the commodity kind of money exchange business and operating instead in the very competitively advantaged customer service business. It also means that First Republic is not a good way to express a view on the yield curve, right? So, but it means for kind of macro agnostic investors like ourselves, we don't worry about getting hurt due to the yield curve. So the stock reacts to interest rates, but this is generally an opportunity for investors to kind of trade the other way because the intrinsic value of this business is not particularly tied to the yield curve. So, you know, this is we think is a great business. It's a customer service-based moat that in theory could be easily penetrated by other banks, but looking at the history of the banking industry and the activities of banks, we think that there is almost no real risk of somebody coming along and actually competing with them well. And so when we turn to valuation, I think this quote from Buffett's an important one. A lot of bank investors feel like First Republic's on the more expensive side, and here we are pitching it as a good bargain. But bank investors have been saying that First Republic is too expensive for years now, right? Even as the stock has consistently grown into its valuation. So Buffett says a high ratio of price to book value, a high price earnings ratio, or low dividend yield are in no way inconsistent with the value purchase. So we don't use the phrase value investing when describing our strategy because too many people interpret it as meaning that we focus on stocks with low valuation ratios. But Buffett's quote is a way more accurate description of value investing, and that low valuations certainly can signal a value opportunity. But they are not a requirement for something to be a good value. So when we think about valuation, the numbers I'm going to be talking about here as we wrap things up are as of January 3rd. So the stock was trading about 86. I think it's like 87, 88 right now. And so it was trading about 17 times the 2018 consensus earnings, or about 2.2 times tangible book value. So importantly, we expect that earnings at this bank to grow at a mid-teens rate for the next 3 years or so, probably a lot longer. And we don't count on longer growth than that in our base case. But honestly, this bank could grow at a double-digit rate for a decade or more. Meanwhile, the bank stocks as a group traded just 14 times 2018 earnings, or about 2 times tangible book. And, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes people get married to certain valuation multiples as if they were separate from kind of the cash generation ability of the industry. Like, you know, banks should have a certain PE just because they are a bank, or a retailer should have a certain retailer-like multiple. And we think that's just a misinformed way to think about it. Instead, it's that certain businesses generate certain levels of ROE, ROIC, and have certain growth characteristics and certain ability to control and reduce their cost of capital through borrowing in ways that's sustainable. And all of those things drive a certain level of multiple, and that's the multiple that can generate the cash yield, kind of the shareholder yield, plus a growth rate to get to your hurdle rate. And so 2x tangible book value is about where banks, and they certainly have had long periods of trading above and below that. But over the longer term, that's been a pretty close to an average number. It's interesting, you know, going back 5-6 years ago, you know, maybe it's a trading at 1x tangible book and people thought that was expensive. But as long as you believe that ROEs can be at kind of historical average levels for the banking industry, then something like 2x tangible book seems like a totally reasonable valuation. But that industry is not going to grow rapidly like First Republic. And so, you know, if you look at the KBW Bank Index and estimated growth rates, you're talking about kind of low single-digit multi-year growth. And we think that's kind of the right way to think about the banking industry as a whole. When we talk about the terminal valuation, how we think about the value of First Republic once it reaches maturity, we're talking about 5 years plus. Like I mentioned, this could be a decade or more away, but in our valuation, we assume it's kind of, they have about 5 years of growth runway ahead of them. And we assume that they can generate about a 14% ROE. This is about 13% on their bank business, a little bit of lift from their wealth management business. Wealth management is beyond the scope of this presentation, but it's a plain vanilla kind of registered investment advisor business model. It's perfectly well run, and there's not a big commission business or anything exotic that would worry you. They're providing relationship management, customer service for wealth management needs. When we think about their growth slowing at maturity, we assume that ROEs will stabilize around that level, which is, it may be a premium at that time to what the banking industry as a whole can earn. We wonder if whether many of the regulations that have been put in place will turn the banking industry in kind of a financial utility business model with more limited returns than they earned prior to the financial crisis. But in the First Republic's case, we think they can kind of generate this 13% ROE on their bank business plus a little bit more. And honestly, when they do reach maturity and can't grow as quickly as they are now, it may well be that they can be more aggressive on pricing, get their ROE higher. They won't be as constrained from kind of pure pricing, but, let's face it, no one's going to, borrow 7% from First Republic if they can borrow 5% from the big dumb bank down the block, right? So there's definitely a limit to where they can drive their ROE, and we think that their moat is kind of best expressed through their ability to grow and retain customers. At a kind of 14% ROE, they'll need to reinvest about 35% of their earnings to grow at, at a kind of a nominal GDP sort of growth rate, leaving about 65% to distribute. So with 65% distribution, if you want to get a 4% distribution yield plus your 5% growth to generate a long-term 9% return. So again, this is our kind of a fair value, not that it would be the cheapest stock in the world at those levels, but that's where you'd be fairly compensated at throwing this stock. You're talking about a 16 times multiple, again, at the terminal rate, a little bit of 16 times or about 2.1 times tangible book. And I'd note that this is just a little bit below where the stock's trading now, right? And yet the company is growing their earnings in a mid-teens sort of run rate. And so one way to think about the valuation is that the current valuation gives you all of the growth for free. Addressing the fair value, current fair value directly, we believe that over the next 5 years, the company can grow revenue at a low to mid-teens rate with NOPAT, and it's not commonly thrown out with banks, but it's how we think about all of our businesses, is what kind of NOPAT can they generate and how much of that can be returned to shareholders. We think it'll grow faster than revenue as the growth investments that they're putting through their income statement now begin to fade and their margins improve some, but we're not looking for a lot of margin enhancement. And we think that, taking it all together, you get about 110 as the fair value for the stock. So that's about 20 to 22 times the 2018 earnings estimate. And we give that range because street estimates point to about 22 times. In other words, 110 is about 22 times the 2018 consensus. But we think that the net margin rate may surprise the upside a little bit. And they only recently have been signaling that they're going to be driving even more growth investments to their income statement. And while this may depress their 2018 earnings a little bit, it's a very good thing. It's that they think that there is a lot more growth runway. And the biggest way to drive value in this business to outperform our own upside expectations is for them to be able to grow faster and longer than we expect. So a kind of a cleaner picture of their current earnings run rate might put the stock more at 20 times. But whatever it is, it's in that sort of range. So, I'm sure the deep value investors on this call look at a kind of 20% discount to fair value and feel like there's not enough margin of safety. But we view the moat as the major element of safety, margin of safety for all of our businesses. We always want to pay a discount to fair value. But this is the sort of business that grows its intrinsic value every day. And with 20 to 25% upside to fair value, if it takes kind of 3 years or so for the valuation gap between our assessment and their assessment of fair value and the current market valuation to close, if that takes about 3 years, we're going to earn about 18% IRR. If it takes 5 years, maybe it's more like 14% per year. But if neither of those things happen, it's okay with us, right? So at the current price, we're happy to buy the entire company and own it on a private business basis, for the rest of our careers. And that's true of everything in the ensemble portfolio. So we are never buying a position saying, hey, in some time frame in the future, other investors are going to assign some multiple to this stock and we'll be able to flip it to them. We're assessing the businesses for things that we can hold forever. We typically don't. We have kind of 3 to 5 year holding period, sometimes much longer, but that's because typically over that sort of time frame, either we realize we're wrong, which happens occasionally, of course, or the market comes around to our point of view. And we exit the position, not because it's a no longer an attractive long-term hold, but because something even more attractive has come up. So more than any other company in our portfolio, when I explain the pitch on Ensemble, the pitch on First Republic, I often feel like I'm being promotional, right? So here's my last slide. It's a First Republic ad, right? But here's the thing. Since first researching First Republic in 2012 and buying the stock, we've moved Ensemble Capital's banking relationship to First Republic, and every shareholder of the company has moved to the bank as well. So at the end of the day, we're members of the client base who give the bank such a high net promoter score. That's what I'm doing right now, promoting the business, right? The fact is we're fanatical supporters of the bank. That's their business model at work, and it's one that we believe in deeply. So thank you so much for having me, John. I really appreciate your interest. We're a huge fan of NOI Global, and it's been a pleasure to be here.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for such a clearly and compellingly articulated thesis on First Republic. If I may, I'll just reflect personally. I've been a customer probably since 2000, I'll say, well, just about 2000, maybe 2001 or two. And even after I moved to Switzerland, that's the one U.S. banking relationship I kept to this day, and I still use First Republic. So very unusual, but they've been really, really exceptional in terms of the customer service. And, you know, like you said, you develop a relationship with a person rather than just the bank. And it does have a lot of stickiness to it. Just curious, are you aware of any other banks that try to follow this model that one could perhaps look at and study in addition to First Republic?
You know, so I think that there are not other banks that regularly go head to head with First Republic. In the Bay Area here, there's Silicon Valley Bank, which maybe has some comparison to them. Each of the kind of higher end banks out there have something a little bit different about them. There's definitely an element of kind of classic high-end customer service from First Republic. But what's interesting about them is that they have a bank branch in the Twitter office. There's one placed on the first, the Facebook campus. And even though they kind of exude this kind of classic old school banking charm about them, they've resonated very strongly in the Bay Area with you know, kind of the modern technology, high net worth family. And I think that's an unusual thing that they've been able to pair. So, you know, certainly there are other banks and there's, you know, the storied banks like a Northern Trust and things like that, that offer, you know, a similar model. But in terms of their direct end market, we think that they're truly a class themselves.
When assessing the runway ahead of them, do you have any sense for the penetration, if you will, in their target customer segment?
So I mentioned that they have about 4% market share of the high net worth families in their end market. So despite the fact that there's just kind of three cities that make up most of their client base, this is about 60% of the high net worth families live there. And so, you know, they have a much higher penetration in the Bay Area where they started. We think there's no reason why they couldn't kind of double that sort of market share over the longer term. So we think that they have a very long way to grow. One thing that's interesting, and I'll mention it here, but it deserves a longer treatment, which is why I didn't talk about it in the main presentation, is that when the bank was founded in the 80s and well into the 90s and you know, all the way up into the financial crisis, the first banking product that a young but high net worth and destined to be higher net worth family needed was a first loan to buy their first house. And so that's kind of the lead product that First Republic sells, right? This is kind of a jumbo mortgage to a high net worth family who's going to buy a house in the Bay Area or Los Angeles or New York. But especially in the Bay Area, that's no longer the first product that the high net worth and destined to be higher net worth customer needs. It's a student loan refinancing package. So it used to be that somebody in the Bay Area who came out of a good school and was making good money would be looking to buy their first home in their last 20s, their late 20s. Unless you're coming from a lot of money, that's just not the case anymore. And instead, you're graduating with a $250,000 loan package, and you need to refinance that and have it at some sort of better rate with a good banking relationship. And so in recent years, they've been building out kind of a student loan refinancing package that's designed specifically for kind of high performing young professionals. And those are the people who, after refinancing, earning more money, paying down debt, would move on to First Dollar to get their first home loan. So it's interesting the way that the demographics have changed as housing prices and affordability has changed. But you know, this is kind of a new area and a whole new area for them to penetrate.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on the top management, how you view them, their incentives, and whether perhaps connected to that, looking down the road, whether a sale of the bank could be a possibility?
Yep. So chairman is also the founder, is not in a technical sense owner-operated business. In about 10% of S&P 500 companies are owner-operated sorts of businesses. About 50% of Ensemble's portfolio is, and it's not an attribute that we screen for, it's just that when we look for really well-run, really successful businesses at a much higher rate than average, they are operated by owner-operators. But there's also the sort of owner-operator that may no longer have a huge the business as an owner who's passionate about the business. And we think that's very true of the management team, who doesn't own as much as they once did simply because they were brilliant enough to sell the bank in 2007 and then buy it back with the help of private equity in 2010. They're older. Would they sell the bank again? Well, they did once 10 years ago. I don't see why they wouldn't again now. There's been rumors at different times in the past couple of years that people were looking at them. They don't have to sell the bank. We would love to see the bank operate independently over the very long term, but we think that there are significant incentives for the management team to sell the bank in the next couple of years, just from a personal standpoint. And I think that they're a kind of a crown jewel for the right larger entity to buy.
And Sean, just lastly, are there any concerns or risks that you would kind of have front and center looking longer term? Anything that could occur that would make you reconsider your thesis?
The persistent decline of the San Francisco Bay Area real estate market. So, remember, we've already had a crash in housing prices in 2007 to 2010, and the bank survived that just fine. We've already had an equity market bubble burst from 1999 through 2003, and the bank survived that just fine. Both of those were extremely damaging stress test cases, and the bank passed both with flying colors. But when you look at the level of home affordability in the Bay Area, and I know this as a business owner myself, it is hard for younger people, despite maybe being high income earners, to live in the Bay Area. And if over the next, say, 20 years, San Francisco and the Bay Area is no longer able to kind of command the attraction of bringing, the high net worth and high achieving people to the Bay Area, and the demand for that goes elsewhere, and that would be problematic for them. It would certainly reduce their growth opportunity. Doesn't mean it's going to be a blow up and I have lots of losses in the home. That's not the worry. It's just they have about half the business, 40% of the business in the San Francisco Bay Area, and San Francisco and New York are major engines of their growth. I would definitely take the side of the bet that continues to be the case over the very long term, but it's certainly a risk.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Sean, once again, for taking the time to share your insights as well as this idea with our members.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate your time.
And I would just like to also encourage all of you listening and participating to feel free to follow up directly with Sean with your own thoughts or questions. And as always, should you wish for an introduction, we are happy to provide it. Goodbye for now.